The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Essence Magazine, the January and February 2020 edition. And on the cover of this edition is Halima Aden, and she is a refugee turned supermodel. I'll try my best to get to her article before the end of this month, but if not, then we'll, you know, certainly go over that in February, since this is the January and February edition. So an article that I do want to go over is how far we've come, and it's Black women have been at the forefront of politics and activism for centuries. So in the inaugural edition or issue of Essence in May 1970, a journalist, Gilbert Moore, highlighted some of the era's most important Black women leaders, whom he described as bound together by race, by sex, by impatience, by the simple yet complex proposition that Black people shall have dignity in America and the world, entitled Five Shades of Militancy. The article featured longtime activist and civil rights icon Rosa Parks, Black Panther leader Kathleen Cleaver, Barbara Ann Teer, the artistic visionary behind the National Black Theater in Harlem, political pioneer Shirley Chisholm, the first African American woman in Congress and the first majority party Black candidate to make a bid for the U.S. presidency, and the women of the Nation of Islam. The accompanying images were shot by none other than the famed photographer Gordon Parks and his son, Gordon Parks Jr. And on this, it's just the illustration of some of the women that have come before us, such as Linda Brown, Ruby Bridges, Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells, and Constance Baker Motley. So at the time this piece was published, which was in May of 1970, the concept of Black militancy was nearly as abolitionist as today's wokeness or social justice activism, though perhaps it was infinitely more polarizing in the endless human propensity for generational for categorizing people who were divided Black people into three categories: moderates, militants, and Toms, wrote Moore. It facilitates study and conversation. It is convenient. If Toms were seen as committed to pleasing the white forces that maintain control over Black life in the U.S., and moderates were considered too dispassionate or complacent to pick a side, militants were the women and men who believed that Black liberation was worth fighting for and committed themselves to that fight. The term militant was most often associated with groups like the Black Panther Party and agitators such as leftist organizer Stokely Carmichael, the father of Black power. Real avenues for change, even in the face of willful disregard from lawmakers. 50 years later, Black women continue to be at the forefront of any and all substantive movements for civil rights and justice for marginalized people in the United States. The barriers faced by our foremothers and those they fought for have been vanquished. Racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, transphobia, and socioeconomic disenfranchisement continue to plague our communities, along with the refusal of the world around us to affirm and constructively support the leadership of Black women. Nevertheless, the freedom fighters of today are as militant as our foremothers, as they work to see that our people are treated with the fairness and dignity that we have to yet to experience on these shores. Here we salute some of the women who have made it clear that, as Moore wrote, whatever is required to obtain that dignity shall be done, and whatever forces combine to deny that dignity shall be removed forthwith. A modern-day warrior for truth, Nicole Hannah Jones has garnered international acclaim for her critical work on racial inequality or racial inequity in America's public schools. The New York Times Magazine staff writer has received a number of distinguished honors for her dogged reporting on the long history of segregation in housing in schools, including a National Magazine Award, a Peabody, and the celebrated MacArthur Foundation Fellowship known as the Genius Grant. In 2015, Hannah Jones co-founded the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting to provide mentorship, training, and support for the investigative reporters of color who are grossly underrepresented in newsrooms across the country. The 43-year-old was the driving force behind the Times' critically acclaimed 1619 Project in August of last year, marking 400 years since the first enslaved Africans were brought to the shores of what would become the United States. The multimedia commemoration traced the genesis of the disenfranchisement that Black people face in the present day to the system of chattel slavery and the deliberate racism or racist strategies that sustained it. The 360 Degree Exploration podcast and live events headlined by some of our most impressive scholars, writers, historians, politicians, and artists, and it led to a related curriculum developed in conjunction with the Pulitzer Center. The special New York Times Magazine issue dedicated to the 1619 Project would be reprinted so many times that hundreds of thousands of copies were ultimately sold. Hannah Jones is a modern-day warrior woman, cut from the same cloth as the pioneering journalist for whom her organization is named. While Ida B. Wells held up a magnifying glass to the horrors of lynching, refuting pervasive myths about Black male criminality and properly contextualizing the crimes as an effort to maintain white supremacy, Hannah Jones has similarly worked to disrupt narratives that present African Americans as responsible for their own struggles. School segregation was one of the definite issues of the civil rights movement, and fallout from that policy remains. Yet a cursory exploration of mass media's coverage of issues related to racial injustice might imply that inequality in education is no longer a problem, nor does the media adequately reflect that violent policing and mass incarceration are issues of pressing urgency among Blacks in the United States. Hannah Jones attributes that erasure to the fact that a very visceral reaction of our community to the death of yet another Black citizen at the hands of the police isn't shared by everyone. White Americans are not impacted by us working on police violence, she explains. It doesn't affect them in their personal lives. They may feel badly about it, but it has no real impact. The persistent debate over the value of school integration in terms of how Black children may or may not benefit must include what's involved in bringing those conditions to fruition. In the first place, there is a feeling of why are we going to keep fighting and begging white people to send their kids to school with our children, Hannah Jones says, and I understand that wariness, but as the Iowa native points out, we simply don't have the luxury of giving up. I feel like my whole career has been dedicated to exposing the architecture of real or racial inequality, she says, not just to document that it exists, but to show how it has created and how it still intentionally is maintained. Fighting for environmental justice. While school segregation may fail to sustain the attention it deserves, environmental racism is at times a mystery in plain sight. Like Hannah Jones, Dorsetta E. Taylor has spent much of her career exploring how the conditions experienced by Black people in the United States are indicative of our environment. The Jamaican-born sociologist is best known for her research and writings on environmental justice and racial disparities in the world of ecology. Her works include 2009's The Environment and the People in the American Cities, 1600s to 1900s, one of the first exhaustive looks at the intersection of race and ecological inequality and the rise of the American conservation movement. A social history that outlines how race, gender, and class inform the populations that will benefit or be sacrificed in the name of the conservation and sustainability efforts. Black women are everyday environmentalists. We just don't get the headlines too often, wrote Heather McTeer-Tony of the Moms Clean Air Force in a Time's Op last year, a sentiment Taylor echoes. If you look at the South Side of Chicago, Detroit, New Orleans, and New York City, you see a lot of Black and brown women who are fiercely fighting, educating themselves and their community in tremendous ways, and empowering the youth, all without a lot of resources, says Taylor, who serves as the Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Michigan's School of Environment and Sustainability. African Americans have been doing environmental justice for a long time. We just didn't call it that. As examples, she points to the life-saving efforts of African Americans in response to the 1793 yellow fever outbreak in Philadelphia and the early work of W.E.B. Du Bois. He was actually talking about how, or what we now would think about as housing, environmental issues around environmental degradation, Taylor says. But again, he wasn't using that terminology. We don't have to look far to see the impact of the environmental racism in our lives. We can start at home, not just looking at the products that we use around the home, but also looking at where communities of color are located. Taylor notes, start by asking, why does the freeway run right through the middle of my Black community? In addition to identifying the historical impact of environmental racism and the flashpoint moments that managed to make it to the news, Taylor urges us to be keen observers of the less obvious examples around us. For example, a lack of access to basic utilities can have devastating ramifications, a fact that begins to explain why so many Black families struggle to pay these bills. Electric rates are highest in segregated Black communities because of certain rate structures, she explains, and taxes are higher per unit of housing in these Black segregated communities too. All this can lead to some families being unable to afford to keep their homes. Worse, the resources made available to these communities typically fail to reflect what residents pay to remain in them. Taylor praises young people for connecting the dots and examining everything from residential segregation to pollution, to the destruction of communities with facilities or freeways, or dumping, to energy, climate, health, and equity justice. Young people, she says, understand that all these travesties are part of a continuum rather than a series of isolated challenges. They don't make this mistake we've made in the past of thinking that environmental justice is not as important as fighting against police brutality in poor schools. The young people understood that the environment is just as important, and they've become very active, around it. Taylor makes a point of uplifting powerful environmental justice work taking place in cities across the country, including Detroit's 7-acre D-Farm or D-Town Farm, West Harlem Environmental Action, and Blacks and Green, a Chicago-based national network dedicated to land stewardship and educating folks about the harms of climate change and the benefits of a new green economy. They're doing restoration work, cleaning up the neighborhood, creating gardens, creating farms, reinvigorating Black living spaces, artwork, you name it, she says. And that's going on all over the country. Blacks and Green activists cite the Underground Railroad as a source of inspiration for their work, making a connection between their efforts and that of its most famous conductor, Harriet Tubman. Had to have a significant amount of environmental knowledge to do what she did, explains Taylor. Escape safely, bring other people along, go back and get more. Yet we tell her story as simply a story of overcoming slavery. While Tubman is indeed best known for helping hundreds of enslaved Africans flee the brutality of the plantation and find freedom, she was also a leading abolitionist, fighting to destroy an abusive, dehumanizing system of forced labor and bondage, a role that Taylor believes is completely comparable to modern-day efforts to promote the right of communities to live free of environmental injustice and targeted discrimination. Demanding fairness at the polls. Stacey Abrams embodies the spirit of the late Shirley Chisholm's efforts to effect radical change from inside. Abrams spent 11 years in the Georgia House of Representatives, seen as a minority leader before the historic 2018 campaign for governor that would establish her as one of the most important figures in the Democratic Party. Abrams was the first Black woman to become a major party gubernatorial nominee, and she received more votes than any prior Democrat in Georgia's history. However, she lost by a narrow margin to Republican Brian Kemp, who, as the sitting Georgia Secretary of State, was also responsible for supervising the election. It is widely believed that Abrams' defeat did not take place at the polls, but instead was the result of a rampant voter disenfranchisement, including Kemp's documented effort to purge well over a million voters from the rolls during his tenure as Secretary of State. Kemp then put an additional 53,000 registrations on hold just 1 month before the election. Abrams both refused to concede defeat and sued the Board of Elections. She subsequently decided to take on the pervasive inequalities in our electoral system formally. Last summer, she launched Fair Fight, a nonprofit dedicated to ensuring fairness and accuracy not only in our state and national elections, but also in the upcoming 2020 census. Injustice is not a new phenomenon, says the Wisconsin-born Mississippi-raised politician. Therefore, our obligation is to never waver in the battle to defeat it. She credits her parents with instilling a sense of obligation to work on behalf of the greater good. They always reminded us that no matter how little we had, there was always someone with less, and it was our duty to serve that person. That upbringing inspires the work I do. The continued need for African Americans to fight for voting rights and is perhaps one of the nation's cruelest realities. Since 2008, the year Barack Obama was elected as the nation's first Black president, red states across the country have taken measures that have made voting more difficult for populations that typically cast votes for Democrats, Black folks, the elderly, college students, and so on. A 2014 Supreme Court decision stripped away one of the most important measures of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Which had required lawmakers in states with histories of discriminating against voters of color to obtain a permission before changing local voting rules. Voting is a critical power, one that is being stolen by those who were elected to defend it. Abrams said, through our votes, we have the ability to shape the future of our communities by electing leaders who share our values and respecting our contributions. To reclaim our power, we must participate in every election from judge to state legislator to president, and we must be counted in the 2020 census. So moving on to another article is Blackxit for You. So as the African, or as the Black, let's see, as the Black travel movement continues to move momentum, some African Americans are not only visiting far off places, but they are also relocating there. As poet Warson Shire says, maybe home is somewhere I'm going and never have been before. It may come as no surprise that the United States, a nation of great wealth, privilege, and power, no longer feels like home for a growing number of Black Americans. If it ever truly did. As Malcolm X put it in The Ballad on the Bullet, his seminal 1964 speech, being born here in America, does it make you American? Why? If birth made you American, you wouldn't need any legislation. You wouldn't need any amendments to the Constitution. I don't see any American dream. I see an American nightmare. During the Great Migration, more than 6 million Black folks fled the Deep South to escape racialized terror and later then enforced subjugation by Jim Crow laws. Families moved north to cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, and west to Los Angeles, shifting the cultural and demographic landscape of the United States. The nation's white and wealthy founding fathers encoded the dehumanization and oppression of Black people into the U.S. Constitution as a means of preserving their power and privilege. Despite later amendments granting Blacks and other people of color civil rights, prejudice, violence, and discrimination persisted American pastimes as likely to be expressed under the stars and stripes as under the Confederate flag. Violence against Black Americans was too seldom penalized under the criminal justice law, as evidenced by the proliferation of police brutality cases in which officers escaped accountability, a situation that continues today. Many in the Black community discovered that merely leaving the South did not protect them and their children from the efforts or the effects of institutionalized discrimination. It actually, more recently, social scientists have noted that we are in the middle of a reverse migration trend, with African Americans choosing to leave the skyrocketing rent and concrete jungles of urban centers to return to the more affordable soil of their grandparents and great-grandparents. Since the election of President Donald Trump, however, it has become increasingly clear that there is no corner of the United States where it is safe to be Black. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the number of hate groups operating in the U.S. rose to 1,020, a 7% increase from 2017, a spike that could possibly attribute it to Trump's rhetoric. The Black Women's Roundtable 5th Annual Power of the Sister Vote poll, conducted in partnership with Essence, found that criminal justice and policing reform are the number one issues for the Black women surveyed. And in 2018, the number one issue was hate crimes, racism up to 55% from 33% in 2017. Taking into consideration that the United States is the largest jailer in the world, food apartheid is sickening rural and low-income Black communities, and gentrification is displacing many of us. It's not unreasonable that some Black women are fed up with this nation's inability to measure up to the myth of its founding ideals, even though those principles were not initially meant for us. While Blaxit, the term used to describe the migration of Black Americans to other countries to escape U.S. racism, has been more modest than expected in the wake of the 2016 election. The number of African Americans relocating to Accra, the capital of Ghana, is on the rise, with up to 5,000 Black American expats living there now. With more of us searching the world for a place where we won't be viewed as second-class citizens, the continent of Africa has been a logical landing place. I didn't leave the United States because of Trump, says Claire Soares, founder of Up in the Air Life, a tour company that connects luxury travel experiences around the world. I left because I wanted to explore a life abroad where I wasn't looked at as a Black or white person, but simply as an American, which is what happens when you are abroad. I left for a lower cost of living, the ability to live the same life as I had before, but for a fraction of the cost. Soares, who lives between Mexico and Virginia, sees Trump as a symptom of a deeper problem. I don't believe Trump created this environment in the United States, notes Soares. It always existed, but instead of being covert, it's now more open, or out in the open. Michelle Horsley, a Black American educator residing in Doha, Carter, has no plans to return to the United States. By the time Trump was elected, Horsley had already been teaching in Cairo, Egypt, since the middle of 2015, says Horsley. I thought it would be a 1 to 2 year stint, but after witnessing what was going on in the U.S., I had no desire to turn. So while anti-Blackness can show up most anywhere, for some Black expats, it doesn't have quite the same sting or urgency that it does in America, which makes it a lot easier for them to breathe. I have no desire to move back stateside, Horsley says. I won't say that every day and every experience has been without conflict living abroad, but it is not worse or more bizarre than what occurs back home. Living abroad, I can tell the world my home and find my happily ever after. And this was written by Kirsten West Savely, and she is the senior editor for Essence. And we're actually going to stop right there because we've actually run out of time for today's episode of Essence Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. And I'm Nicole Hunter, and you have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you.